From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with a test result. Artist and illustrator Katie Wheeler had woken up with what she described as a pounding headache and a churning stomach. She went to a free COVID testing site, but when the symptoms went away in a few hours and she got her period later that day, she writes that she figured she had her explanation for why she wasn't feeling great. Days went by with Katie going about her normal activities. She went to a movie theater, a restaurant, and a hair salon, each time showing her proof of vaccination and wearing a mask. She didn't have any symptoms or any reason to worry. She even had her previously scheduled physical exam, no issues. But later that week, during a game night with friends, Katie's test results came back and she was positive for COVID-19. She went into a 10-day quarantine. During that stretch, she notified the people she had spent time with that she had tested positive for COVID. They all went out and got their own tests, and their results were negative. Days after her initial test, Katie tested negative too. The experience, she said, showed her the importance of free, accessible, and consistent testing and of the vaccine she had. In King County, Washington, where she lives, the likelihood of a breakthrough infection, based on the numbers there, is about 1 in 10,000. Katie said the vaccine saved her from severe symptoms and from hospitalization. Katie shared her story with the website The Lily, and hers is one of many where fully vaccinated people have contracted breakthrough infections. Chances are many of us who are vaccinated will still get COVID in some form, but the likelihood of us ending up with a severe case or being hospitalized is a lot less. As writer and journalist Catherine Rue writes, sterilizing immunity might be a biological myth. Medical experts back that point, that vaccines providing complete immunity to COVID or to any infection is essentially unachievable. Wu writes, quote, "Our future with SARS-CoV-2 then will be more about domesticating the virus than about eliminating it. With widespread vaccination, many of us will still be exposed, maybe even temporarily colonized, but it won't often be a big deal," end quote. This hour, we're joined by medical experts who weigh in on the purpose of vaccines, how infections work, how they affect us, and what they think the public should understand about protection against severe illness. If you think about where we've gone in the last year, about a year ago, right on the doorstep of hearing about the approval of vaccines, we were still hoping for flu vaccine success numbers, 30 to 60% perhaps, maybe a moving target. That'd be great. That would help. We were a little bit spoiled with the initial version. COVID 1.0 had about, you know, the 95% for the mRNA vaccine. It's kind of spoiled us. We're probably not going back there, and that's okay. But this hour, it's a chance to understand what the vaccines do, how they impact us, and how they are part of the future of making sure we all can sort of live among this stuff and move on here. So let's talk about it. My guests are, as I said, the vaccinators, Dr. Deborah Pierce, Clinical Associate Professor of Family Medicine at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Pierce, welcome back to the program.
Good to be here.
With us on the line is Dr. Elizabeth Murray. Elizabeth is an Assistant Professor of Pediatrics, a pediatrician at Golisano Children's Hospital. Dr. Murray, welcome back to the program.
Hello, thank you for having me.
And Dr. Stephen Cook is an Associate Professor of Pediatrics and a pediatrician at Golisano. Dr. Cook, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
I just got through reading a piece this morning from an NPR reporter out in Seattle who had his own breakthrough case about a month ago. He writes that, you know, it was very COVID-y. I mean, it was headaches, it was fever. It wasn't fun for a few days. It tailed off pretty quickly, but he said it was a rough couple of days. It wasn't hospitalized. And his own view of that was two things. Number one, he feels eternally grateful for the vaccines because he said, if this is how I feel after two Pfizer doses, what would it have been like for me otherwise? And he is extremely grateful. The second thing that he mentioned, and I'll start with Dr. Pierce on this, he had friends who were saying to him, oh, so I guess the vaccines don't work. And he was saying, no, they do work. I'm the example of how they work because I might be a rare breakthrough case, but I'm not hospitalized. I'm fine. I missed a couple of days of work and I'm moving on here. But the response to him was pretty striking when the lay public was saying, hey, I thought these were safe and effective. What would you say to that, Dr. Pierce?
I would agree. I mean, when the vaccine first came out, we thought it was going to be a miracle and we'd see the end of the virus by springtime. And obviously that didn't happen. But, you know, he's absolutely correct. He had a mild case. He wasn't hospitalized. He felt miserable, but he wasn't deathly ill. And so they are working. They're not, unfortunately, the magic wand that we initially thought they might be, but they make a huge difference. And in many ways, this is still really a huge public health achievement.
Do you think we were a little bit spoiled by COVID 1.0 and the results of the vaccines against initial COVID?
Oh, it was such a ray of hope. And I was I was all there thinking that we were going to see the end. Yes, we were spoiled.
Well, and so where we are now, Dr. Pierce, had we started here last November, December, once the vaccination process started? In other words, if we didn't have the initial results of the Pfizer Moderna is at 94-95%, do you think there would be less public confusion about whether the vaccines are quote-unquote working?
I'm not sure. You know, one of the things that's changed the perceived efficacy is that the virus changed. We have the Delta variant, which is much, much more contagious. And it's really hard to know how many people would have remained suspicious of the vaccine now versus in January, February, if things hadn't changed.
Well, let's ask your colleagues how they see it. Dr. Murray, let me ask you, when you hear about a reporter for NPR saying, you know, he thought his breakthrough case last month was a good example of how well these vaccines are working and how fast he was back to work, and yet a number of people said to him that they thought the result was an indication that they weren't working. Do you see that? Do you hear stories like that? And what would you want the public to understand?
Yeah, I definitely do hear things like that. And I think it's important to remember a couple of things. But one is, you know, what was the clinical question being asked when this vaccine or the vaccines were first being developed? The goal in the study was to eliminate death from COVID or eliminate or greatly reduce catastrophic illness. And so for the most part, that's still definitely happening. It's just, I think that as a society, we've somehow innocently, but somehow kind of translated safe and effective to be without potential for any side effect and 100% effective. And that's really never, ever been the case with anything we do in medicine or science, and certainly not vaccine. We've never had a vaccine that is 100% efficacious for all of the concerning factors. So yes, the fact that he was sick is unfortunate, and I'm certainly glad that he did well, but the vaccine did its job by greatly reducing or eliminating the chance that he was going to die from the disease or be hospitalized from the disease.
So Dr. Murray, the words safe and effective that you keyed on, when you bump into people and they say to you, wait a second, what does that mean? Tell me again, safe and effective means what?
Yeah, safe and effective doesn't mean without potential for side effect, and it doesn't necessarily mean 100% effective, right? It's, you know, measles vaccine, the series is about 90% effective or a little bit more than that, kind of depending on the age group that you're looking at. And so, you know, we want to do the best we can to make something work as best as it possibly can. But there's never going to be a situation where we're going to get the magic bullet that's going to be completely perfect.
And that's
I wish there was the case, and it's okay. And we've always lived with some side effects. And you know, we joke about the medication commercials on TV where they, you know, ramble off this crazy list of stuff. But the reality is that we've always known that anything we put in our body, sure, you could have an allergic reaction. It's incredibly, incredibly rare, and the risk of the disease is far greater than a potential risk of an allergic reaction. But risks like that have always happened, and those conversations have always been happening in primary care offices when kids usually are getting vaccinated.
Dr. Cook, as I turn to you, I'm looking at a couple of interesting pieces of both data and reporting. David Leonhardt in the New York Times has done a really, I think, consistent job of cataloging for us what we know about the vaccines in sort of a snapshot mode, because what we knew 6 months ago is different against Delta. It's a different scenario. What Leonhardt was reporting this week is that you're still, if you are vaccinated, fully vaccinated, your chances of getting, you know, a symptomatic breakthrough case like this reporter in Seattle got, still about 1 in 5,000. That's the numbers. It's pretty low. But when a population level number of people gets vaccinated, when millions of people, tens of millions of people get vaccinated, 1 in 5,000 still means a lot of people, and probably eventually someone in your circle or someone that you know might be you. And so it's it's not usual, it's not common, but it's not something that we'll never see. And I think that maybe has been misreported. And Dr. Eric Topol was reporting this week. He's a professor of molecular medicine at the Scripps Research Translational Institute in La Jolla, California. He said, "I do think the chance of having a symptomatic infection has gone up substantially thanks to Delta. That doesn't mean most people will. It just means a lot more than in the previous version of COVID, and that's okay too, because the vaccines are still working." Dr. Cook, do you see it that way as well? Do you see maybe a little bit of a reality check, but while we also recognize the fact that there isn't anything to indicate that the vaccines are, quote-unquote, not working anymore?
I agree. I think, there's a couple really important points here. You know, we've become a society that fails to read the fine print. When the Pfizer-Moderna studies were done, they were testing on the outcomes of severe disease and hospitalization and death. And severe disease was defined as being in the ICU on oxygen. So being in the hospital but not on oxygen would be moderate disease, or being home laid up for a week feeling like garbage would be mild to moderate disease. And they didn't test statistically on those factors. When J&J came out, they did. And if you look at the original paper, they reported transmission asymptomatically, mild disease, moderate, and then severe and death. And there was a confusing point there. People were like, well, what? How good is it? It's 70%. Yeah, it's 70% when you average all those factors. But it was 90, 95% for severe disease and death. And it was about 50%, 60% for asymptomatic or mild disease. So the Moderna and Pfizer studies never did those parts of the study. They never, because that requires like testing everyone in the study regularly to detect everything. So they didn't do those. And that's fine. But we never told that story correctly up front. And now we are at this point of, well, it's breakthrough. It's not breakthrough, because a positive test can be anything from no symptoms to feeling like garbage and almost feeling like you need to go to the hospital, and that will occur. And so, you know, it's understanding and explaining to people exactly what we're seeing. And the reality is, you're right, we are preventing severe disease, and we have to do this on a large level. Otherwise, other people's health gets impacted for other things. That heart surgery gets put off, that back surgery, that eye surgery, chemo, other things get delayed. So we have to look at this at a very broad range. And understand what the impact is. But when you live in a small circle of people, or you don't live in a very densely populated community, you know, one case doesn't have the same impact as if it happens in a large apartment building or more densely populated area in terms of spread. So we got to get this message out more consistently and clearly to people. But these vaccines are working extremely well.
Yeah, and that last point is, I think, so important. The concerning scenario for everyone is a new strain of COVID that evades vaccination, and we are not there yet. Now, we will say there have been more than just Delta. There's different mutations in different places. Delta is the dominant strain in this country and in many places because of how transmissible it is, but not because it evades immunization.
Exactly.
We could eventually get one that does. The likelihood, from everything I've read, is that if there are mutations that evade vaccination, they won't be as transmissible as Delta. So we're going to see different flavors of this. And who knows, maybe we'll get that sort of worst case scenario that send us back to square one. But we are not there. And this hour, I would love to hear from listeners on a couple of things. Number one, if you're vaccinated, do you have any questions about infection, what to expect, how you're doing with that? I mean, whether you or someone you know might have had a case of COVID despite vaccination. If you want to share that story, if you've got questions for the doctors, you can call 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI, if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. We'd also like to know what it has been like sort of in your circle. Are you doing what you've normally done in terms of social scenes? Are people sort of getting along, you know, whether you're going out with friends or people usually on the same page? Are there people in your circle who are still not really interested in vaccination for different reasons? And there are different reasons. I think sometimes the media sort of, and I'm sure I'm guilty of this, we sort of make it a monolith, but people still have different reasons about why they're not vaccinated. And if you want to share what you're hearing or concerns about that, you can do that too. So We're eager to hear from you, and we certainly appreciate the doctor's time, because I think this is a critical moment as we head for the fall and things have shifted with Delta. So before I take some phone calls, let me ask all three of you. Dr. Pierce, I know you've mentioned on social media there are times where it's frustrating for you, because I know how much you appreciate these vaccines. And when people are, you know, not interested, it can be tough. But there are different reasons they give you. Are you finding anything these days that is more effective when you're communicating with patients?
I think it's just trying to get the message in over and over again that things are changing. The new variant is very contagious, and this is our best hope to keep people out of the hospital. And I think looking at the vaccine is sort of like an umbrella. You know, if you look at all vaccines as being like umbrellas, if it's not raining very hard, you're not going to get an infection. And the same with Delta. It's so transmissible that it's like being in a downpour. So people are more likely to get a little bit wet with it than something like the measles, which isn't very much in the community.
Do you get frustrated? Do you have good and bad days with this, Dr. Pierce?
It's exhausting.
What gives you hope then?
That sometimes people's minds are changing. Slowly but surely, we're increasing the number of people who are vaccinated.
I think what's heartbreaking is when people's minds are changing when someone ends up hospitalized and fighting for their life and they're not vaccinated. And unfortunately, in the American, particularly in the American South, I mean, I'm not sure if people, I've been sort of a junkie on the numbers here. I'm not sure if people have kept up with exactly the disparity here, but you want to see the best evidence for vaccines you can imagine. Look at the numbers of hospitalizations and deaths in the least vaccinated states. So the least vaccinated states in the country. For a while, the least vaccinated state was Mississippi. It's now the third least vaccinated state. Mississippi's the third. There's a lot of talk about Florida these days, which I get. I mean, Florida's got huge numbers of hospitalization and death. But the leading state in the country, as of about maybe Thursday or Friday of this week, New Jersey is going to get passed. It used to be New Jersey was number one, New York number two per capita. Number one by the end of this week is going to be Mississippi. It's amazing, that change, how Mississippi has catapulted to the top of a list that nobody wants to be on, and they've been the least vaccinated state. Their daily death numbers are staggering per capita, just amazing. Florida, if you're wondering, Florida was down in the high 20s. I mean, they were sort of middle of the pack, and there was a lot. Governor DeSantis spent much of the spring talking about how they've kind of moved on, that they did really well, and they're about to be in the top 10. I mean, again, a list you don't want to be in the top 10 on. They are moving into the top 10 by the end of this week, and that has been a huge number of daily deaths. They're averaging 350 daily deaths to COVID. New York State is averaging about 38. It's almost 10 times more in Florida. And then look at the number of the least vaccinated states. Idaho's the least vaccinated states. They have the highest numbers of hospitalization and deaths that they've had at any point in the pandemic. Wyoming, second least. West Virginia, number four on the list. I lived in West Virginia. Jim Justice is their governor. He is a gregarious, big Republican, well-known. Jim Justice has sort of gone viral with his videos. If you haven't seen him, he is so frustrated with the low levels of vaccination, and he is the most blunt person I've ever seen about COVID. He will do news conferences and he'll say, how many people are about to die? Probably a lot, because they didn't get vaccinated. And this is a Republican governor. He is pulling his hair out in West Virginia. Their numbers are through the roof down there. So, I mean, and then it's North Dakota, Louisiana, Tennessee. Those are the least vaccinated states. Their numbers are really, really rough. It's not a good time to be living in places like that and to not be vaccinated. It's not a good time to be anywhere and not be vaccinated because of how dangerous this is. So I don't say this as propaganda. I say this as facts. I want people to understand what we're up against right now and why people like Dr. Pierce get so frustrated, because the states that are the most vaccinated are doing much better. We don't have a fourth wave right now, and I hope we don't. Dr. Murray, how do you feel? I mean, do you feel the frustration that Dr. Pierce was talking about?
Well, my primary clinical setting is in the emergency department, and so it's a little bit different. But I will tell you, we now have the ability now, you know, the plus side of seeing some young adults on the peds side of the emergency department is we have the ability to offer COVID vaccination and flu shots, for that matter, too, for people. And so it's been nice to be able to have those conversations and see some 18, 19, 20-year-olds there for, you know, cuts or broken bones or things like that and decide, hey, all right, if you talk to me about it and time is, you know, right place, right time, and they are willing to start their vaccination series. So that actually has been a positive, but I think it comes down to the one-on-one conversations. These aren't people coming in looking for the vaccine. It's just we had it available to them. We answered their questions. And I think that's what we're seeing. You know, the mass vaccination early on was great to get the people who had early buy-in. And now we're at a place where people have lots of really good questions because there's understandably questions, but there's misinformation and disinformation out there as well. And so we appropriately are changing our strategy a little bit where we have to have these vaccine clinics where you have a tremendous amount of educated providers available to really take maybe 15 or 20 minutes. I mean, Steve, I think, can speak to this a ton, to go through all of the information that the patient has been using to make their decisions and kind of figure out what's been the right information, what's been the wrong information. You know, how can we help them make sure they have what they need to make a choice for their health? And so this phase takes a lot longer and a lot more person power than it did early on.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Cook has made an important point in the past, and I wonder if you want to just talk a little bit about this, Steve, that when we look at Florida's vaccination numbers, Florida is one of the most vaccinated states in the American South. They're middle of the pack for the country. It's upper 50s, something like that, in terms of percentage of vaccination. So it's not a high number, but it's not as low as some other southern states. However, I think you've pointed out there is a lot of people who may have been vaccinated in Florida who don't necessarily live there year-round.
Yeah, absolutely. I've had probably at least a half a dozen people who came into vaccine pods and said, oh, I got a dose down in Florida at a Walgreens, or I got one, you know, and they have their card and it's written on there. And, you know, thank goodness we can enter them into the NICIS database. But, you know, the way the numbers get tracked is they get tracked by where it's been administered. So if you got it in a Walgreens in Idaho, then, you know, Idaho gets credit for it. So early on, they were running, you know, kind of these, you know, they mobilized very well. They really focused on elderly, but they were, you know, taking anyone in the door. And a lot of people, you know, went down there and got vaccinated. They've also not been very transparent with their numbers. And if you go look at something like the New York Times, which has tracked data continuously, they report every time these states change how they report. Like Nebraska, you know, no longer reports county-level data for deaths or cases. They just report it as a state. You know, Florida, not, you know, only reporting death data, you know, as a state once a week. Now, we are doing that for a county, but we're one county, and we have data that's uploaded. So, I mean, I think it's very different. And so the lack of transparency there is something that's really important. But, you know, having that conversation, this is what we're at. The people who are remaining are either, you know, very adamant anti-science. Some are very adamant personal choice, but may not be anti-science. But then there's a lot of very concerned people, and they take extra time.
Yeah.
I have
yeah.
held the hand of people who have been into vaccine pods two or three times before and walked out and got them across the finish line to get their dose. So, you know, it's not one blanket approach. We need lots of strategies to do this. And it is really frustrating, the information, misinformation we have to deal with.
Yeah, and sometimes it's as simple as people working two or three jobs, no benefits, and worried that if you happen to get side effects from a vaccine and you miss work for a day or two, you can lose a job. That is still a significant number of people who are worried about missing even a single day of work. And there has to be accommodations made for people who would probably do this if they had help. So I think Dr. Cook is making vital points here. A lot of good questions coming in. Let's start taking them. And I'm going to start with Lisa in Rochester. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead.
Hi. Oh, gosh. I'm so happy you're doing the show today because I have questions like every single day about this. Okay. So I had both my Pfizer vaccinations, one in March and one in April. And so I went out with a friend on Friday night to a restaurant. It was very, very crowded, no masking, nothing like that. And it really couldn't have done it. It was counter seating. And so I left and I felt kind of nervous. And I guess I'm thinking like that. I feel like I'm still, that I should still be doing what I did before the pandemic, keep a distance, always wear a mask in a public place. And, but I'm wondering, do I need to be that vigilant? I have been vaccinated. So,
yeah,
you know what I mean? I wonder if
sure.
I'm being overly nervous or.
So hang there, Lisa. Stay there for a second. I think I heard Dr. Cook jumping in. If you want to start, Steve, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it is about risk and what risk you're willing to tolerate. And, you know, so who else are you around? Who could you potentially spread the vaccine to? How careful are you in those settings? So, yes, we do need to get back to living more and having more regular lives. So you got vaccinated. First, most important point. Try to be careful where you go and how densely populated it is. Know what the background community rate is. You know, doing that in the east side of the county is probably much safer than other parts of the county, because when you look at vaccination rates, they vary by 30%, 40% just in zip codes in our county. So understanding that, you know, honestly, look at the staff. Look at the servers. They're the people who are there the longest. If they're not wearing masks, then I'd be a little concerned. Just because they're in the building the whole time, and even if they're asymptomatic, they're spreading, you know, they could be spreading over a long period of time. So it's, you know, I would recommend you wear one to make yourself feel comfortable, but you also want to, you know, be able to live your life. Now, if you go home and you have you care for an elderly patient or elderly family member who maybe couldn't get vaccinated or is immune compromised, or you have a child who's not vaccinated because they can't get vaccinated yet, you know, then you're, you know, are you potentially bringing it home to someone who's susceptible? So that's where you kind of have to weigh this and look at these, how we live our lives. But you're right, we have to get back to a little more. We can't still be as fearful as we were 12 months ago, but we do need to be more cautious than some of these states that we're seeing.
Dr. Murray?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, the vaccine is like facial recognition software, right? And so instead of our body having to figure out, you know, who is this invader? Is this a good guy or a bad guy? Oh, wait a minute, this is a bad guy, let's go. It goes immediately to, boom, we know this is an invader we got to take care of, but still takes some time to get that robust immune response after you've been vaccinated, right? You have your immune response to the vaccine, but I mean, once you identify that the germ is in your body takes time to make enough neutralizing antibodies, and that's the trick with Delta. So that it replicates so fast that you're able to spread in that little window of time before your body is totally ready to really fight it off the germ or lessen your infectious capabilities. And so, you know, as a mother of now, luckily I have a fully vaccinated as of Monday one child, but then an unvaccinated other child. You know, I'm kind of weighing my risks as, you know, if I get sick, what does that mean? You know, am I likely going to be okay? But that means that my kids probably won't be able to go to school for a while. My kids could get sick. My child could get very sick and risk, you know, potential for MISC down the road. My husband is also a physician. Does that mean he can't work? He's an ICU physician. We don't want to take ICU physicians out of the picture right now. So I think, you know, Steve's exactly right that risk is very different for each person, and risk can also be cumulative, depending on what you do over the course of your day or over your week. So it's frustrating. We want to be done. We don't want masks anymore, and I totally get it. And it's a frustrating thing to have to do, but I usually err more on more frequent masking than less frequent masking. You know, has there been times in the past few weeks where I've met my friends who are all fully vaccinated to have a cocktail sitting outside at a place we trusted? Yes, but that's because we had lots of safety layers built into it. My family's not going to indoor restaurants right now because it just, the risk is too great for my family right now.
Okay, Dr. Pierce?
I think wearing a mask is sensible anyway. I mean, if we look at what happened last winter, there was very little influenza. And I anticipate I'll probably wear a mask in crowded indoor spaces through flu season anyway. So I think COVID or no COVID, a mask is not a bad idea.
Yeah, and I would just say, if I could just add my own brief perspective on this, Lisa, because I'm sort of like you. You wonder, you know, what's the most sensible thing? You know, there's people in my life who've been dealing with cancer, other immunocompromised issues, et cetera. I've talked a lot about my aging parents and the struggles my mother's had with pneumonia. I'm very, very sensitive to the people around me, even though I am not worried about me pretty much at all. I mean, I know that I could get COVID. I know that likely I'll encounter COVID. Maybe, I don't know, maybe I already have in the last couple of months and I had the vaccines just shut it down. Who knows? I'm not worried about me. I am worried about people who may be around me. Now, I'm also worried about my community and businesses and moving forward and getting kids in schools. And so when I'm out, if I go to the grocery store, I'm wearing a mask. I now wear a KN95. I didn't love giving up my really cool cloth mask because I had a great collection. But what we know from the data is that in COVID 1.0, all kinds of masks did really, really well against it. Bangladesh published a study out of Bangladesh a couple weeks ago, and found that cloth masks do less well against Delta. KN95 and N95 do really well in protecting the community. So, you know, if I'm in a grocery store, I pop the mask on. It doesn't impact my experience there. If I'm going out to meet friends, I'll probably mask up until I'm sitting or staying in the same place, and then I probably take it off. So, you know, it's up to you and the people around you as well. That's kind of where my mindset is. But I don't want businesses losing customers. I don't want people shutting down their lives. We've got wonderful vaccines that are working. I want more people to get vaccinated, and I want to be as smart as I can with Delta around at the levels it is. That's kind of where I am. Does all of that make sense to you? Lisa?
Do you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I feel the same way, Evan. I want to do the best I can for those around me and stay safe for myself. And, you know, I do wear a mask almost always. But I think my question was like, you know, like, am I overdoing it? Should I feel more? It was more like I feel the same way kind of as before I had the vaccine.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But you've answered me. You've answered me very well, all of you. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the phone call. I mean, I feel great going out. I am so grateful every day. I can't express it enough. The vaccines have done so much to help us move forward, but I think we still have work to do to get to a point where we don't see the levels. You know, 150 cases a day in this community? I mean, a case doesn't mean a hospitalization. But Dr. Murray, you, your husband, I mean, you can speak a lot about hospitalization. How would you say hospitals are doing locally in terms of COVID?
I think it's kind of different depending on the hospital. My husband's hospital, actually, I don't know where they are as of today, but the other day they had opened up a third ICU team. You know, the children's hospital is doing quite well right now, but we're seeing all sorts of RSV and other things. You know, I was going to be in studio with you today, and then I thought about it and realized, gosh, I just worked on Sunday, and I saw all sorts of kids with all sorts of infections, and I had my PPE on, but still, it just, if I could call in, it was a safer choice, and so that was the choice I made for this show. You know, so it really does impact everything we do, but I think that it's understandable that when you're caring for a critically ill person who consciously chose to not get the vaccine, that weighs on our healthcare providers for sure. But I think there's still a lot we can do to get information out to people who need it so that they can make safer decisions for themselves and their families. So, yeah. You know, I think the bigger healthcare issue right now is the moral injury and the psyche of our healthcare providers.
Wow. Wow. I also want listeners, as we go back to the phones, to think about the fact that different countries are doing it very differently. I mean, in Australia, they're trying to get to COVID zero. One of the provinces in Australia, states, what do they have there? States, provinces, places, you know, territories. I'm not an Australian. They debuted an app in which you could get a phone call or a text from the government, and you had 15 minutes to take a picture to let them know that you are, you know, you're not out in a place that you're not allowed to be. 15 minutes is not a lot of time. There's a whole lot of surveillance going on in Australia. That's lockdown. That's an effort to try to get to COVID zero. This country is, I think, probably realistically not trying to do that. We're just trying to figure out a balance of living in this particular moment and getting forward and not trying to end up like Louisiana, Mississippi, Florida, Georgia, Tennessee, Idaho. I mean, the numbers are really rough in a lot of places. And I mean, you just heard Dr. Murray say, it's not always rosy here, but we don't want to get there. So let me get next on the phone. I'm sorry. Look at Sam in Rochester. Hi, Sam. Go ahead. Oh, wait.
Let me try. Hi, Evan. Thanks.
Yeah,
thanks
go ahead, Sam.
Taking my call.
Yep.
I had a question about ivermectin. A lot of people are talking about getting prescriptions for ivermectin. And I've done a little bit of research on the internet, and I can't find any good studies. I know there's one by the University of Oxford that they're doing an ivermectin study, but there's a lot of anecdotal stuff out there about it. And you know, I don't believe any of the studies unless they're a double blind study, you know, the gold standard.
Yeah.
And I want some comments from your guests. I'd love to hear.
Sure. And I'll start just by saying, you know, I've tried to do as much reading on ivermectin as I can journalistically to understand what's going on here. Ivermectin is a drug that has helped people, not just animals. I mean, that I understand sort of the memes that are out there, but it has done really good work on things like river blindness. You know, it has been a very effective drug when targeted for specific purposes in people. And so it's totally natural, I think. It's very human to wonder if there's anything out there that can be a magic bullet against COVID, either prophylactically or as a therapy. That is absolutely natural. We know that with hydroxychloroquine last year, it's easy to sort of get sold a bill of goods when you don't have evidence. And so with ivermectin, what we need is a lot more evidence than we currently have, because a lot of what has been shared has its own flaws. There's a lot of flaws in the data out there. There's a lot that's incomplete. And the data that I have seen, and I'm ready to be corrected right now by the guests on this panel, the data I've seen indicates it probably doesn't help all that much against COVID. I mean, we can certainly hope that maybe a bigger trial somewhere will indicate otherwise. I know in India, in South America, in places with lower levels of vaccination, they've been trying it. They want to use it if it's going to be helpful. And I think, again, I understand why. But the best bet you got is the vaccine. That is what you have. Dr. Pierce, am I describing that pretty well so far?
You are. I mean, I think there was a study in a lab that showed extremely high doses of ivermectin might have some efficacy against the virus in a Petri dish, but that's doses that would be extremely toxic to humans.
Yeah. Yeah, I read the same thing. I think that they cultured a COVID infection in cells from a monkey, and it took a very high level of ivermectin, but in a lab, it was effective at wiping out COVID. So the two things that would have to happen there is transfer to humans in the wild, so to speak, not in a lab, and with lower doses that wouldn't be toxic to humans. I don't think we've seen it from the
evidence. No, we haven't. And right now the data is that vaccination is still your best bet, and ivermectin doesn't seem to have really any promise, even as a last-ditch effort from my reading.
Yeah. Okay.
Can I?
Go ahead, Dr. Murray.
I think a really critical point here is we are not, or at least I certainly nowhere have I seen doctors saying ivermectin is a bad drug. Ivermectin is a great drug for its intended purposes and the appropriate doses. What we are seeing, and appropriately so, because to answer your caller's question, there really are not any robust studies that show efficacy in this situation. And so what doctors and healthcare providers are saying is ivermectin is not helpful in this situation. We wish it was. There's other inexpensive medications that do get used regularly, such as Decadron, which is a steroid. It's not a very expensive medicine. So the argument of we want to just use fancier things really doesn't play out here, because we're using Decadron, or the people in the hospital are using Decadron to help COVID patients. So that's the point, is it's not to be used in this indication. You know, if you have the drug manufacturer themselves coming out saying, please don't do this, I think that's a really good indication that we do not have good information to say use this medication in this situation, because the manufacturers are going to be more than happy to produce more if they could sell it, but it's just not to be used in this situation.
Okay, Dr. Cook?
That's exactly a point I was going to make, too, is Merck, the manufacturer of the drug, would love to be able to relabel it for a new indication and charge more. And trust me, I want a cheap, effective drug to treat this for people who can't get vaccinated or people who are having severe infections. But the reality is that there's a number of studies that get published preprint, which is before they've been reviewed, and people can look at them, and a number of them never get finally printed. Some of them get retracted, which we've seen. So they make it to print, and then the flaws are pointed out by secondary reviewers, and they're retracted. But none of these studies have consistency of dosing and consistency of outcome. Some look at symptom resolution. Some look at severe disease, or does it prevent hospitalization? And you're getting inconsistent results across different type of outcomes. And they're smaller studies, 50 people, 100 people, even when you pool it. So let's look at that and let's take that for our value. Small studies, different types of outcomes, minimal effect. But I want to trust that. But I've got two drugs that have been studied, one with 30,000 people, one with 45,000 people, and they prevent death like nothing else. And they're two doses, minimal side effects, and yet you don't want to believe that. So if people don't want to believe that level of science, it's so frustrating as a provider. Like, then how will you believe anything else I support? I mean, when people are like, well, I don't trust the FDA, I'm like, then you can't trust any medication I'm going to give you because they're all approved by the FDA. So let's try to be reasonable and just, you know, take a look at this. Trust me, I want a cheap, effective drug I could give people. And we don't have it yet. I mean, we have Decadron, that's good, but that's, you know, a specific setting. But we've just got to get a little more reasonable here, people.
All right. John writes to say, Evan, can your guest describe the levels of protection with vaccinations versus convalescence? In other words, getting infected and recovering. John is hearing that more people are describing that natural infection is better than vaccination. Let me start with Dr. Pierce. What would you say to that?
At this point, early on, it seemed as though natural infection, the immunity might wear off. It's also unclear how robust natural immunity from Alpha COVID is against the Delta variants. And so I'm still recommending that patients get vaccinated even if they had COVID.
Okay. Dr. Murray.
So I'm going to be a real stickler on this, and just the phrase natural immunity just kind of bugs me a little bit, because whether you it's really disease acquired immunity versus vaccine acquired immunity, and both happen in a natural way. Your body develops the immunity in the same way. It's just potentially to a different degree. And then the key point is you don't risk having the actual disease itself. And so, you know, I think natural has this connotation of therefore healthy and must be safe and okay. But natural is never meant safe and healthy and okay. It's just kind of how it occurs. So, you know, disease-acquired immunity carries a tremendous amount of risks, and right now the information looks to show that there's a lot of variability in as far as the amount of immunity that is generated with regards to the duration. And so vaccination does appear to be more consistent. I think it's an interesting question, and it's definitely already being looked at of, you know, if you've had it, you just need to have one dose, different things like that, especially, you know, as we try to make sure we vaccinate the rest of the world. Are there going to be a subset of people who only need to have a one-shot series instead of a two- or a three-shot series? These are really important questions, and they're being looked at. But right now, we don't have enough data to fully answer it. But we know we do have enough data to say the safest option for the greatest number of people is to vaccinate.
Okay, Dr. Cook.
It's all true. And what we do know also is with vaccination, we're seeing people, if they get a secondary infection, much less severe disease, and they don't spread it as long. So we don't know that if you get reinfected again. And I'm not saying it does or doesn't. We don't know that. We just don't have the data. And we are seeing people getting breakthrough infections. I had a kid tell me he doesn't believe it and stuff. I happened to notice he had a Baltimore Ravens jersey on. He said, you know, you get infected, you're okay. I'm like, you know who got infected twice? He's like, who? I said, I can't remember his name now. The quarterback.
Lamar Jackson.
Lamar Jackson. Thank you. Oh, my God. Watched the game last night and everything. And he's like, no. I'm like, go look it up. It's on ESPN. And not that I want people to do research on ESPN. I want people, if they want to do research, go to a library and have a librarian walk you through research. Because, you know, you can find anything out there to prove your point. But have someone walk you through reputable resources of information, because, you know, anyone, disgruntled employee, you know, smart person with or without a degree, can create a web page that can look as slick as anything and give themselves all kinds of credentials to proclaim, you know, their expertise. But, you know, find good, reliable resources, because, you know, we are studying this. We're getting huge amounts of data in real time on this, and it's truly transformational. And it's not sustainable in terms of how we practice medicine, but, you know, it's something that is so important that we are able to show people, listen, there's some benefit there, but it's not sustainable. And we see a very good sustainable effect from these vaccines. And, you know, let's just try to follow the science.
Yeah. I'd like to endorse Dr. Cook's idea of don't just claim that you're, quote, doing your research if you're looking for something that backs up your pre-existing opinion. And maybe ESPN and celebrities aren't always the best place for that. Nicki Minaj did us all a favor last night when she demonstrated that that's not always the best place for it. The pop star and actor said that that she's still too busy. She's busy doing her own research, so she hasn't been vaccinated yet. But she did hear from her cousin in Trinidad, who is not going to get the vaccine because his friend got it and became impotent with swollen testicles. So her cousin's friend in Trinidad had a thing. That's probably not the best kind of research, is all we're saying.
So, Evan, let's have a connections journal club where we can walk through how we critically review an article.
That's a great idea, actually. That's really good.
You can simulcast it on FaceTime, so everybody can Facebook Live. So
I really think that's great. Do you think, Dr. Pierce?
Absolutely.
I think we need to do that type of work also with our local data. You know, that's the other thing. When people see abstract information, they don't realize it. And I really wish whatever powers that be would give, you know, a good reporting out of where we're actually seeing numbers and stuff. Because the good sign is that we've done such a good job vaccinating, we probably won't see nearly the pediatric surge that was seen down south. I mean, our doubling time in Monroe County is like 6 weeks or longer, you know, going from 1% to 2%.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go out to like Livingston County further out, it's 2 weeks. You go down south, it's less than a week. You know, so again, because we've done such a good job with the vaccines, we're not seeing, you know, the rapid rise that we saw before. We've been hovering around 3%, 4% for weeks now. And in states that have high vaccination rates, the kids are far less likely. The states you mentioned before, those kids are getting admitted to the hospital 4 to 5 times higher degree. Not because the disease is worse. There's just so many more infected.
We're masking here.
That too.
Well, let me just try to squeeze in a little bit more before we lose the hour here, because I've got so much feedback. Rebecca says, Evan, I want to share that my mother, who is 84, and has many medical problems, including hypertension and obesity, and my 91-year-old aunt, who has severe asthma, were infected with COVID 3 weeks ago. They live in Florida. Both of them recovered within a 2-week period. Neither required hospitalization. Both were vaccinated. The vaccines work. Rebecca, thank you, and I'm thrilled to hear that that story had an ending that was better than when I started reading that email. I thought, oh my gosh, where are we going? Good luck to your family, Rebecca. Thank you. Mark is asking, is the J&J vaccine still effective? Hey, Dr. Pierce, I got the J&J vaccine. What do you think?
Right now it appears to be so. It's being actively studied, and I think there are studies going on to see if people who've had the J&J vaccine should get an mRNA booster or not. Right now the answer is the J&J is holding up.
Yep. We're going to see more
Stay
in
tuned.
The weeks to come. Yeah, absolutely. We're right on the doorstep, I think, of getting more information there. And a number of questions about kids. Let me turn to the pediatricians. Dr. Cook, I'll start with you. Kids and vaccines. We could see the Pfizer vaccine. They're trying to kind of at least push the timeline. We could see by the end of October, more likely maybe November or December, but we don't know yet. And some parents are already saying, we've got emails from parents saying, hey, in Britain, they're already saying they're going to recommend 1 or 0 doses for kids because kids handle this so much better. And there's concerns about, you know, other effects of the vaccines for kids. But that's not what I'm seeing in other countries. So what's your current position on where we are with kids and vaccines, Dr. Cook?
We're going to probably have a vaccine. We're going to have a vaccine available in this country probably end of October, potentially out in terms of data by then, out for November, December. We have to adjust the dosing. They seem to be very effective. You know, you can argue about vaccinating or not vaccinating. In England, they're doing a lot more testing. They're keeping kids in clusters and pods, so they're not freely mixing in schools. So they're doing a lot more different strategies than just saying, oh, we're not going to vaccinate. Go look at Brazil, where they've not been vaccinating. They've been using hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, and there's been well over 2,000 children have died from COVID. So, you know, let's find where the common ground is. We need to get a vaccine to young kids. Again, the number of kids who get seriously ill is small, but right now none of them are vaccinated, and we're seeing in communities where it's not happening, the children's hospitals are getting overwhelmed, and pediatric cases are getting delayed, and other cases for adults get delayed because the adult hospitals have to help out for the kids. So let's, you know, we have a simple, effective intervention here that, again, is very safe. Okay. And that's why it's taking a little longer. They want to assure the safety. The studies probably could have been completed for effectiveness sooner, but they've asked for more safety data, and that's why it's taken longer.
Okay, Dr. Murray.
Yeah, the safety data on the concerns for myocarditis continues to be very encouraging. It's in favor of the vaccination, and I agree with every single point Steve made. You know, if we have the opportunity to prevent the disease, that is almost universally better than trying to treat it when it comes along.
And we had a question from a listener named Amanda who had a breakthrough case recently. She lost her taste and smell, wondering if there's anything that can be done to bring it back. Dr. Pierce, I don't know. I mean, there's training that some groups are doing to try to get people to get their sense of taste and smell back, but that's a tough one. Hopefully it comes back naturally. What are you hearing?
Really mixed. One of our residents had a breakthrough case in July, and he still doesn't have his sense of smell back. And you know, what I say mostly is try to take good care of yourself. You know, maybe B vitamins will help a little bit, but it's really, at this point, it's not known.
Yeah, there's not a lot of good science on that. Most people do get it back eventually. There are cases, as Dr. Pierce mentioned, of people losing one of those senses permanently, or at least so far permanently. We don't know how much permanence there will be going forward. But the good news I hope you're all taking from this conversation is that the vaccines still work. They work very well. Safe and effective does not mean 100%, but the numbers are really, really high. And that's why society continues to move forward wisely with these mitigations in place. Dr. Steve Cook, thanks for making time for the program today.
Thank you.
Dr. Elizabeth Murray, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Get your flu shot.
And it is flu shot season. And Dr. Deborah Pierce, do you have your flu shot?
Not yet, but I will soon.
Yeah, I missed the clinic in-house. I think I'm going to Wegmans. We're back with more Connections in a moment.